I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. We've been asking people about their work this late summer of 2015. Here's a sample, and there's lots more on our website.
My name is Rosemary Spindola, and I've been doing this work for 23 years, something like that. Probably I came here in 86, and then I started working in restaurants. And then I thought about start my own business, cleaning business. Work out pretty good for my kids, you know, the second year in college, you know, freshman in college, you know, and doing this work very hard every day for supporting.
My name is Matteo Passanisi. I work at Red's Best here on the Boston Fish Pier. Do wholesale fish, seafood distributing here. Guys are unloading boats whenever the captain lands. Yeah, it's hard work. You're on your feet for 12 hours straight at bare minimum. We all work pretty much 6 days a week. You do get a sense of accomplishment. You know, the fish is piled up to the ceiling some days, and when you're done, it's all out the door at the end of the day. So it's all fresh seafood coming in at night, and it's gone, you know, by the end of that day. You're like finished, you know, and you feel good about it.
My name is Rose LaVita, and I do dressmaking. I think that all the people that they used to do this work, from Greece, from Italy, even from Portugal, they're dying out. But this is a trade that you really have to be somebody special for the kind of work. You have to have an eye for it. You know, once I got married, things were different. But, of course, I worked harder to get to a point where I am. I'm not rich, but maybe in my old age I might be able to live comfortable. Or maybe I have something to show because it was two people working hard. That's how you're making life.
Our North Star in this quest learned the truth about low-wage work by doing it. Waitressing, cleaning, making beds, retailing at the back of the shop.
I worked for Walmart for a while. You know, I have a lot of education to find out that I should never use that word unskilled again because no job is really unskilled. And if you don't think so, try it yourself. I mean, I would just mention waitressing. That is the multitasking Olympics, and the rewards are pathetic.
Barbara Ehrenreich wrote the book Nickel and Dimed on work at and below the minimum wage. The basic rules she learned back around 9/11 times still apply. All jobs are physically demanding, for example. The hidden crisis once you've found a job is finding housing. In a trailer, or maybe a friend's spare room. Motels are expensive. Privacy and the standard civilities do not apply. Your handbag will be searched. Poverty is a state of emergency. Ends do not meet. The condition is not sustainable. The real philanthropists in this country, Barbara Ehrenreich decided, are people who work for less than they can live on. They are giving something away to the rest of us. Barbara Ehrenreich collects stories today for her ongoing economic hardship reporting project. The job market has been up and down since Nickel and Dimed in 2001, but her lessons through the 08 meltdown and this inch-by-inch recovery haven't much changed.
Well, one of the jobs that had the most powerful effect on me, emotionally and physically, was being a maid with a house cleaning service. You know, this is where you go out in a little team, you wear a particular vest, your car has a logo on it, team rushes into the house and has so many minutes in which to clean it. I mean, that could be like 100 minutes, but it could be less. You know, it would seem like, well, what could be easier than cleaning houses? I've done that all my life, but not under that kind of time pressure. It's very damaging. I mean, your knees go, backs go. And the pay, it was so sad. Some of my coworkers were not getting enough to eat. And that's not something I expected to find in America. In fact, when I first saw these women not having anything for lunch, we didn't have a lunch hour, mind you. We would go to a stop at a convenience store, and that was your chance to get something. And they would get like a bag of Doritos, a little bag. And I'd be thinking, what's going on? You know, you can't do this physical labor on that. And it turned out they didn't have money. And I found that out when we were driving from house to house, and there'd be a question of paying a toll on the highway. You know, 50 cents or something, or a dollar. Well, I'd have to pay, or we'd all pitch in a little bit. And that's how I realized nobody was dieting. they simply couldn't buy lunch. And there was a couple of young women who complained to me about being weak and shaky by the end of the day. Well, of course, they didn't have enough to eat. And I would further point out, just because I think it's important in this case, these were white, native-born American women. These are not immigrants, which now is very likely the case with house cleaners.
What's changed, Barbara, since the meltdown?
Things have gotten worse in several ways, I think. One is we're seeing a degradation in even the notion of what a job is. 15 years ago, I could go looking for jobs and find them pretty easily because there was a lot of hiring going on then. And it was an expectation that a job was something like 40 hours a week in return for pay. I knew there was something a little more intrusive about it right away because, you know, in many of these situations, you have to take a drug test to get the job. And one of the things that does to you is it signals that your life is not your own anymore. You know, that what you do off the job, if you were to smoke an illegal drug off the job, that's also under the purview of your boss now. That kind of thing has grown. There are now employers who will not hire smokers of anything. You know, their blood tests that can detect nicotine. So that's another intrusion into the rest of your life. But, I mean, the main thing that's changed is that this 40-hour-a-week kind of thing is gone. People now, like at Walmart, are struggling to get 30 hours a week. The trend is more part-time people and no guarantee that you'll make a living. And then one step beyond that, there is the new emphasis by employers on just-in-time hiring, meaning they're not going to offer you a job and say, yeah, we're going to give you 30 hours a week, show up at this time, etc. They're going to say, we'll call you when we need you. Now, that may mean you have 3 hours of work one week, 20 hours the next week. You can't plan your child care. You can't do anything because you're waiting for the phone call. Fewer employers are offering any of the accoutrements that went with a job in the old days. Guaranteed 40 hours of work a week, maybe not benefits. That's all pretty much deteriorated. The white-collar example of this would be something like TaskRabbit. You get a gig to come and hang somebody's curtains for them. You do that in an hour. You're out of there. You're paid for that. You see if you've got another gig on the other side of town or something. One of the things that inspired me to launch this project 4 years ago is, you know, the understanding that some things had changed quite a bit since Nickel and Dimed, that things I had not clearly paid attention to at the time have increased, like wage theft, in which the employer deliberately underpays people. And this is not just a small-time kind of thing. Yeah. This is Walmart. And estimates of over $100 billion a year are taken, essentially, by employers from their employees through one form or another of wage theft. They would just tell a person to punch out, say, at 4 or 5 p.m., and then come back to the floor because there was much more work for them to do. So that's off the book. That's just a contribution you're making to the corporation. There are many forms. So what began to strike me few years ago is how many things we, and I use that term loosely here, as a society do that actually make it harder to remain poor or to get out of poverty at all. Another thing is the whole criminal justice system, which fortunately has been highlighted a lot since Ferguson. The point there is that it's very easy to get in trouble with the law if you don't have money. And the classic example is having a brake light or something that fails, and you can't afford to get it replaced, but you get stopped by a cop, and the fine for your transgression will be more than it would have cost to replace the brake light. Now, if you can't pay that, then you begin to pile on more fines. If you get summoned to court, and you don't show up at court because you didn't get the summons, which is all too common, or change your address, then an arrest warrant goes out for you. And then the costs just multiply and multiply.
You wrote a good deal about that in Nickel and Dimed. You said that civil liberties and a lot of other basic American rules don't apply in low-wage jobs.
That's right. This was brought home to me very early in my low-wage career when a coworker at a restaurant actually said, "Be careful what you have in your purse, Barbara, because the boss can search it at any moment." What? No, that's not possible, I said. So that day I called an old friend who was a union organizer, and I said, what's going on? He said, that's right. Once you bring your backpack or your purse into the property of the boss, he or she can search it at any time. Little did I realize that when I enter the workplace, I'm leaving behind the rule of law.
Come back to the Economic Hardship Reporting Project. Slices of the economy, regions of the country, particular jobs. What are you finding?
Well, one of the most powerful stories we've had, which just shows you how crazy things have gotten for working people, is we had a story a few months ago about 24-hour daycare centers. Even 7 days a week daycare centers, which I just found shocking as a mother. And the reason for them is so many people can't control their hours, like the people who work at just-in-time jobs, and because people don't make enough money and have to have several jobs. I mean, I think that is just emblematic of how terribly pressured they are. You know, essentially give up your children or pay for them, of course.
It's expensive to be poor.
Yeah, it's expensive to be poor in so many ways. I come at it often from the service workers, because when I'm talking to people who are comfortable or who are affluent, and I want them to become aware of all the people around them who are making their lives possible, but who are really, you know, almost doing it as volunteers. They're paid so little.
You say they're the great philanthropists of the country.
Yes, and I have impressed on my granddaughters, when a waitress brings you anything, say thank you. Amen. Because she is not being paid enough for what she's doing. So she's doing you a favor. Every one of these little tasks that we depend on for convenience or for how we live is at the expense of somebody's life, really. Their back pain, their inability to feed 3 kids or whatever it is. That's the other side of the life you may enjoy as a consumer.
That was Barbara Ehrenreich of Nickel and Dimed. You'll hear her again. Coming up, would you like a job on the data-driven management team at the retailer that's richer now than Walmart? The Amazon story is next. This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source. And the second of 3 radio hours on work and what's working in an economy described as flexible, disrupted, transitional, maybe recovering. Amazon is, of course, the giant brand in all-purpose online retailing of absolutely everything, books, lawn chairs, phones, vacations. In the past month, New York Times reporting has made Amazon the brand name for the theory and practice of white-collar management defined by extreme and unrelenting stress. Chairman Jeff Bezos is the captain of the Amazon ship. Our guest, Nikhil Saval, is the social historian of management cults and heroes that led over the years to cubicles everywhere and the pressure testing at Amazon. Along the way came the incentives for real estate salesmen in Glengarry Glen Ross, the David Mamet movie and play. First, Alec Baldwin from the movie, and then Nikhil Saval, the author of the Office Chronicle, Cubed.
Because we're adding a little something to this month's sales contest. As you all know, first prize is a Cadillac Eldorado. Anybody want to see second prize? Second prize is a set of steak knives. Third prize is you're fired.
In a way, there's just a basic principle at work in what Amazon is doing. And in a sense, it's foundational in the office as we know it. And the idea is that each worker is dependent on him or herself to rise within a company. The office is the most individualistic workplace of its kind. Certainly the private sector office is founded on individualism. And one rises by one's merit, and one is constantly in competition with everyone else. That is, in a way, just the kind of ideal, typical office. And what Amazon does is basically exacerbate that level of competition through all the tools available to it. You know, it tracks employees, it encourages employees to inform on each other through an anonymous messaging system. and basically pits workers against each other in this idea that over time, the best of them will be culled, and you'll have this kind of cream of the crop of white-collar workers. This is a very extreme version of it, but it's essentially what a lot of people have tried to do in workplaces for generations. I mean, one of the foundational versions of this is what we would refer to as the Taylorist paradigm of the office, after the management theorist Frederick Taylor.
Right.
Frederick Taylor was actually not really concerned with offices as such. He wanted to create competition for workers on the shop floor and in factories. He created these rudimentary, we would now think of as rudimentary, monitoring tools, stopwatches to monitor people's motions. And then his acolytes eventually started using cameras to eliminate people's unnecessary motions to create the most efficient way to do a given task. And he called it the one best way of doing work. And it was up to his acolytes to extend these ideas to the administrative office. And so people would come up with the most efficient way to lick envelopes, the most efficient filing techniques. People were constantly being watched. Managers were encouraged to create competitions or games among workers to see who could file the quickest, who could deliver messages the quickest across the office, things like that. The quickest methods of accounting, the most efficient methods, eventually to arrive at the one sort of best way, and then to have workers be rewarded for that.
Tumble out of bed and I stumble to the kitchen, pour myself a cup of ambition and yawn and stretch and try to come to life.
So you see versions of this intense monitoring very early on in the history of the office. And the idea behind it, again, is that workers are pitted against each other, and that the best will eventually emerge from this battle royale of white-collar work. What people sort of discovered in the history of work is that, especially after Frederick Taylor, is that in a way people couldn't fully be coerced into doing their work, or that people couldn't simply be disciplined into doing their work, that they couldn't just be punished into working. And that was sort of the ideal that Taylor had set up, that in a way you had to acknowledge at some level that people wanted to be appreciated for their work. Their psychology had to be managed as well as the sheer physical motions of their work. And so there was this movement in the early 20th century that came a lot out of Freud, largely, to figure out how to inculcate a sense of loyalty in the workplace. And you see that a lot in the way people sometimes describe the Amazon environment positively in this story, that you have people effectively talking about how much they wouldn't really stay there unless they loved it. And actually the kind of commitment that they put in is really this devotion to the ideals of the company. That's the sort of seduction that Bezos relies upon, that, you know, eventually if you survive, that, you know, you'll achieve great financial rewards. And then also that you'll have done so basically by beating everyone else. Their workforce has to be sort of agile. The labor protections have to be loose. People who can't survive can be let go on the idea that you'll get more people who want to work in this incredibly profitable place. And again, what you always find in these places is, with Frederick Taylor on, you find an adherence to a special kind of vision and the proclamation that what your company is doing is unique in the world. And everyone has to be sort of submitted to this cult-like status of the CEO leader figure. And it leads to catastrophes in all kinds of ways.
I was struck that Jeff Bezos didn't really deny any of the particulars, like the surveillance, for example, or the encouragement of back-channel reporting on the guy next to you.
No, and he has no reason to, because that other companies do things like this.
He is also, strikes me, he's talking about Navy SEALs, really, the Navy SEALs of office work. And if it's not for you, maybe it's not for you. We'll find another one.
Yeah, that's the ethos of this kind of office. You know, law firms have done this for generations. Investment banking is notorious for this. Famously, a Goldman Sachs intern died from overwork recently. And you find companies that adopt various surveillance techniques like Amazon. You know, just as much as you had people coming out to criticize Amazon, there were maybe not an equal number of articles, but a fair number of pieces that suggested that we actually should not come to bury Amazon, but to praise it. So for a lot of people, this is a kind of appropriate workplace for an economy characterized by creative destruction, or what Silicon Valley people like to call disruption.
That was the writer Nikhil Saval, editor at N+1, author of the book Cubed. Our guests from here out come with different mixes of humanism, futurism, and long-view economics. Writer-filmmaker Astra Taylor, born Canadian in Winnipeg, grown up in Georgia, edited The Occupy every day through the Wall Street Revolt of just 5 years ago. Economist Andrew McAfee teaches the digital economy at MIT. He co-wrote the book on the second machine age, Work, Progress, and Prosperity in a Time of Brilliant Technologies. Astra, you're first. Can you picture yourself working at Amazon?
No. How's that for a simple answer?
For the obvious reasons. Would you be weeping at your desk?
The social Darwinian workplace is definitely not for me. I don't think it's a vision that we should embrace individually or as a society.
Andrew McAfee, Amazon, on one of the middle managers told the New York Times, Amazon is where overachievers go to feel bad about themselves. You know, it's famous now for the image of white collar workers crying in their cubicles. What's good about it? And how long can it last?
I think two things are really good about Amazon. The first is they don't try to hide this aspect of their culture. The article pointed out that prospective hires are told from the get-go that this is how the company operates. The second thing that I like about Amazon a lot is that instead of trying to manage by gut feel or intuition or bullying or charisma, they really try to be driven by the evidence. What's the data? Why do you believe what you believe? Let's make our decisions based on that. You can call that ruthless. I would prefer to call that kind of empiricist, and I fully support that as a management principle. The last thing I would say is that the article was also careful to point out from a couple different people who work there that one advantage of working at Amazon is that they were listened to based on the quality of their ideas and the quality of their evidence, really no matter where they were in the company. So you could be successful and you could be listened to at lower places in the hierarchy. I find that really admirable.
I would want them to take the electrodes off my head and, you know, my pulse rate and all that sort of thing. I'm also thinking, Astra, that Jeff Bezos owns the Washington Post now. I've been a newspaper guy. Could you run a publishing venture, quasi-creative workplace by those rules?
In some ways, a lot of publications are moving in that direction in terms of determining what they should publish based on the metrics or the data.
The instant response, the emotional, and we don't like it, do we?
Well, some of us
like
it.
Well, what it means is that it's created a culture of virality and clickbait that, you know, sort of adheres to the numbers but may not be what we want as a society to always have sort of front and center. So I think there are problems with the idea of empiricism and data. The question is, you know, what is the sort of social and political meaning of that data? What's it for? And you know, is there a sort of, debate about what the standards are? Andrew just mentioned that workers feel like they have a say, but they may not have a deep say over the ultimate metrics by which they're being judged.
I'd like you both to come back to Barbara Ehrenreich's picture, the hardship reporting. And the whole thing we've been talking about for weeks, the precariat, workers with no rights, no benefits, scant incomes, incredible insecurity. Have we accepted this? Astra.
Yeah. I mean, I think we have accepted this to a degree, and there are lots of reasons for it that can be traced back to the 1970s, shareholder revolt that demanded more profits and a sort of shorter return on investment and an erosion of the old welfare state. But I think it's certainly the problem of our time. And listening to Barbara speak, you know, it's something we sometimes blame technology for this shift. So she was talking about just-in-time scheduling, right? Mm. The way there are now systems that monitor workers and can basically say, you know, we need somebody for Tuesday, so you're just going to be called immediately to come in. And you know, it occurs to me that we could be making technology that actually monitors workplaces and monitors for labor abuses and uses the same data that's generated for the cause of employees and employee well-being instead of for the cause of corporate efficiency. So I think we're in a moment where things are actually still in play and things could go in different directions.
Andy McAfee, I'm thinking of your forebear in economics at MIT, Paul Samuelson, less than 20 years ago, talking about the ruthless economy as the womb-to-tomb identification with company and theirs with workers started to fall apart. It's gone crazy in that period.
In some ways, I agree, because this constant quest to wring more, to get more efficiency, to wring more inefficiency out of systems is leading to things like just-in-time scheduling. And I really sympathize with what Barbara was saying earlier. That makes it really difficult to plan a life, especially if you don't have a lot of slack in terms of family or a lot of slack in terms of your financial resources. I find that really troubling. It's also true that we have a stubbornly high percentage of people living in poverty, and that real 50th percentile median household income in this country has been flatlining. I believe the peak was in 1999. So for these workers right there in the middle, who I believe are trying to do the right thing, things are chilly, and we have to start to understand why at a deeper level. I do believe the social contract is changing, and I have some sympathy for what Astra is saying. It's changing in the direction of profits and wringing out inefficiency. There are other forces at play. Globalization has been a big force over the past 15 years, and tech progress has been a big force over the past 15 years. So what I don't believe is that we could will stable, full employment and industrial era jobs with great benefits and healthcare back into existence just if we wanted to. I think the situation's a lot more complicated than that.
Astra Taylor, you wrote a wonderful piece not so long ago about a cooperative that makes windows. And it just struck me that so much of the wealth in this new digital economy is cooperatively built. I mean, they don't call it that at Facebook, but the vast contribution of value to that multi-billion-dollar corporation is the work of you, me, billions of people now doing their bit. How do we get to a redefinition of those social networks as cooperative properties? Or should we?
Yeah, I mean, I think, but you could make the argument that things of value have always been cooperatively produced.
Some more than others, but
the digital, I'm always interested in the question of, you know, what's new about the digital revolution and sort of what is the same? Where's the element of change? Where's the element of continuity? And so, you know, what you have continued over from the old industrial model is the sort of, you know, people at the top who own the means of production and the people who are working. And, you know, it may not be the traditional employee-employer relationship according to something like Uber, where you are, you know, claiming that you are just a platform allowing your independent contractors to do their business.
There's a good example.
Yeah, more decentralized, or like, you know, Facebook, where we're all sort of contributing to the value of the company, but we're not even, you know, customers. We're just users. We're definitely not employees. But I think the question of how the corporation is set up and how the wealth is distributed is a sort of political and economic question more than it's a technological question. And I would argue that the technology might make it even easier to have cooperative models than it was before. You know, it seems much easier to cooperatively run something like Uber than it does to run an entire massive industrial era factory. So I think there are good ideas historically that could be carried over into the digital age.
That's fascinating. I mean, the technology would allow it, you say. I think this liberated political conversation we've got all around us now, from Trump to Bernie to Scott Walker, would allow it too, Andrew. What would you do with those questions?
I completely support letting these alternative models flourish. Let's have some kind of cooperative alternative to Uber. I think that would be a fascinating experiment, in the same way that we have Creative Commons instead of copyrighted media property these days. I think that's great. What I don't want to do is forbid the alternative. I don't want to forbid venture-backed, for-profit startups from going out there and trying to compete in the marketplace. So I'm all for letting 100 schools of thought contend here. I don't want to shut down some of the things that we know are in many ways working well. The ability to get from point A to point B in cities around the world is greatly improved because of Uber, and I think that's a great thing. The ability for people to earn a living without having to rent a taxi medallion and without having to do anything more than drive their car around and fire up an app, I want to be clear, I think that is a net big positive.
Astra, your turn. How long do you give this sharing economy, whether it's your apartment, your car, you know, your delivery of somebody's laundry, your time?
Yeah. I mean, it seems to be growing, and people often celebrate the fact that it's an economy of sort of freedom and choice, but it is also one that's kind of desperation. You know, people are doing these jobs on the side. Will they try to jumpstart, you know, more stable, fulfilling careers? And so what I'd like to see is, you know, a sharing economy worth the name, one that shares the wealth as well as supposedly sharing the car ride or the apartment that's actually being rented. So I'd like to see a real sharing economy, not a rental economy masquerading as one. But I want to go back to what Andrew said about, you know, other reasons for this sort of growing wealth gap we're seeing. And he mentioned globalization, which I agree, and, you know, technology, which we're talking about. But the other thing is the decline of unions. And the decline of sort of organized worker power. And so that is one element as we sort of think moving forward about how to stop this spiraling wealth gap. I do think that people have to come together and start advocating for themselves collectively. And we've seen little bits of this, of Uber drivers trying to unionize, and even media workers. You mentioned the online media scape, media workers at places like Gawker and Salon unionizing. So I think, again, some old school techniques are going to have to come forward into the digital age.
We're talking old school, new school, wide open conversation that could go on for the next year about opportunities to fix this economy. Coming up, in what we call a neoliberal economy, fixated on money metrics, return on investment, human beings as human capital, is there room for what we used to call a middle class? This is Open Source. I'm Christopher Lydon. This is Open Source, the work conversation around what we put into and get out of our jobs. Here is the sound of a Roxbury man doing one of the jobs that you cannot automate yet.
My name is C. Understanding. I work for Everything Is Real Barbershop. I've been doing barbering for 4 years now. It's not hard work, but you got to love what you do. You know, if you love what you do, it's not hard work. You have fun doing it. So I love what I do, so it's not hard for me at all. This is how I provide for my family. This is how I provide food, clothing, and shelter for my family. I got five kids, four boys and one girl. And it's flexible. You can leave and go when you come. As long as you pay for your chair, you can do what you want to do. Right now, I'm just lining him up, refining his lineup, and, you know, just so you can see it and make putting some definition to it. And that's, you know, that's part of the haircut. You know, you can get a haircut, but haircut without a lineup is not a full haircut. Well, after every haircut, when I see my client smile, he feel good. It makes me feel good. Not only are we barbers, we're therapists. You know, sometimes a person comes in, they're having a bad day. You know, they're not feeling good. You know, they got stuff on their mind. So as you cut their hair, you talk to them and you try to, you know, give them some positive insight. And, you know, as you're making them, refining them physically, you can refine them mentally. You understand? So now you're making them look good and you're also making them feel good.
This is part two of our three-part open source series on work, a wide-open conversation that could run Labor Day to Labor Day through the presidential campaign for sure. Andrew McAfee and then Astra Taylor, speak to the satisfaction in that barber's voice.
Yeah, I love two things about that. The first was the clear pride that guy took in his work.
Yep.
And it was obvious to me that he got a lot of his sense of dignity from being a really good barber. This is what work does for us. It is not universally a soul-destroying experience. It can be a huge part of a healthy life and a healthy community. The second thing he said was, as long as I can rent my chair, I have freedom to work as I want to. Flexibility is incredibly important for a lot of workers. One of the things that worries me is that a lot of what we do in the name of worker protection is explicitly reducing that flexibility. For example, a couple generations ago, about 1 in 20 workers needed a license from the government in order to do their job. That number is now about 1 in 3. That is not a trend in the right direction. What I don't want is for that guy to have to go through some kind of school for 8 or 12 months before he's allowed to practice his trade of barbering. There's a lot more of that going on over time. A lot of that is done with the best of intentions in the name of trying to protect people. I don't like it.
Astra Taylor, I hear Emersonian self-reliance in that barbershop. What do you hear?
Yeah, I mean, I also appreciated the fellow's satisfaction from his work, and I agree that work doesn't have to be soul-destroying. At the same time, I feel like we are often too fixated on jobs, right? Because jobs are a source of sort of everything in our society. There's such a of economic security, but also often health insurance, you know, our retirement funds. Mm-hmm. So we've created this unusual model where sort of everything's contingent on your employment. And, you know, I think there are some interesting thought experiments to do about decoupling work from the sort of basic necessities of life. Mm-hmm. And I think that would be a way to increase human freedom. Is a direction we should be moving towards, especially as people, you know, are sort of stuck in these precarious part-time work situations.
Yeah, I can, Chris,
definitely don't have the sort of emotional benefits we're talking about.
Chris, I completely agree with that. America is a very weird country because so much of our social safety net is tied to our employment status and the prestige or the value of that job. That's when you need the social safety net, is when you don't have that kind of good job. So I'm with Astra. I think the ACA is a step in the right direction, and I support other efforts to try to decouple the social safety net from your employment status.
I'm kind of shocked by our Barbara. There's a man cutting hair, five children, talking about supporting them and seeming to make it work. You're not old enough, Astra, to remember when that was the rule. One wage earner supporting a family and a house and a car, probably. What should, abstractly, ideally, what should a regular worker be able to expect for what he or she does every day in the way of things you've mentioned, security, insurance, a sense of self, a living wage?
Yeah, I mean, I think that those for people who are willing to devote 40 hours of their week to their job, and the truth is many people are working more than that. I mean, a lot of people are, you know, not only money poor, they're time poor. They're working multiple jobs. I feel like people should be able to have this sort of not just basic necessities, but the stuff to sort of live a dignified and comfortable life and access to healthcare, education, all of those things. At the same time, I think we do need to look beyond our obsession with jobs if we're going to tackle this issue of inequality, if that's ultimately what we're talking about.
What do you mean?
Well, because the issue of inequality goes beyond just sort of if we can just stabilize the middle class and get everybody a job, things will be fine. And we have issues of the problem with the tax code and the fact that the wealthy are basically enjoying a sort of tax revolt, a legal tax revolt at the moment. We have problems with defining the health of our economy in terms of gross domestic product and economic growth and jobs when, you know, there are environmental arguments to be made about the negative effect of economic growth on our environment, you know. So maybe there could be a world where it would actually make sense to incentivize people to work a bit less than they're working now, and that might make us healthier in other ways. So I think just assuming jobs are good, more jobs are better, it's just a sort of limited frame of reference. I'd like us to think beyond it a bit.
I love the idea.
Yeah, a higher standard of living and a growing standard of living is the goal that we should aspire to. We need to keep in mind that these forces of globalization and tech progress are putting some pressure on different categories of worker. At the same time, they are bringing higher levels of material affluence and abundance and bounty to our world and to our economy than we have ever seen before. The average American family, in many ways, has access to things and access to a standard of living that would boggle the imagination of the Rockefellers. And my point is not that they should therefore shut up and stop whining. My point is that we are actually making progress in some deeply important areas, and we need to be aware of the sources of that. The other thing that I would say is I am squarely focused on those workers right there in the middle, those workers at the 25th percentile, the 50th percentile, as opposed to what's happening up at the 1% or the 1% of the 1%. The fact that there are some extremely rich people in this society actually doesn't bother me all that much. If they were clearly hijacking the political system and perverting it to their own ends, that would bother me more. As I've looked around, the extraordinarily wealthy are bitterly divided politically. I think that's probably a good thing.
I'd ask you both. I mean, Astrid, did you have a thought there first?
Oh, I mean, I just absolutely disagree. I think that they are hijacking the political system. I think when, you know, under 100 people control almost half of the world's wealth, we have a major problem. We have a major problem for democracy. And so I think as much as we're focused, it's for me, I'm focused more on the people at the bottom. I think that, you know, I work as an activist with people who are not just struggling in a minimum wage job, but who also have tens of thousands of dollars of debts from predatory for-profit colleges they've gone to get a vocational degree for jobs that don't exist. So there are people who not only are not making enough to live on, they're also deeply indebted. And so we can talk about raising the minimum wage or maybe even a guaranteed minimum income. But, you know, what about a sort of maximum wage? Let's sort of have a sort of a floor that people can't fall below. And maybe let's have a ceiling as well. I'm not sure that we need the tippy top people to be as rich and powerful as they are.
I want to go wild to the possibilities, Astra. And, I mean, you mentioned we have a bought and paid for dynasty-ridden, wacky presidential campaign, and yet it's amazing to this moment, the iconoclasm. We've got a Wisconsin Republican who wants to bury unions forever. We've got a Vermont senator running strong under the banner of socialism. It seems to me the public campaign is inviting us to think wild. And let's go for it.
Well,
and
I
what time we have.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, no, sky's the limit of what could be talked about and may be possible.
What's really weird to me is that the popularity of, on the left, and a socialist who's really trying to put into place or advocating some of the things that Astra talks about, really almost confiscatory taxes up on the high end. On the other end, a billionaire right-winger who's also incredibly popular with working class people in this country. That polarization shows me that there are a lot of people who are feeling very left out of some of the progress that we're seeing. And I think they're feeling left out for good reasons. They are ascribing very different causes to why that is. And then they wind up supporting Bernie Sanders or Donald Trump. But this feeling that the that some things are racing ahead and people are being left behind, that seems to be a large and growing feeling.
But boldness is winning, I mean, on the right or the left. So let's seize the possibility, Astra.
I'm with Andrew. It's a very strange, it is a strange political moment. And I think part of it is that we are seeing a sort of younger generation emerge that has a sort of different political framework, right, that doesn't really remember the 70s and certainly doesn't remember the Cold War and has different associations with words like capitalism and socialism than the generation that came before it. And so I think a lot of these predictions we're making about the future are so rooted in this moment of massive inequality and sort of deregulation, right? So we're assuming that there's going to be this future where people, there's mass unemployment due to automation and machines, and there's a kind of dystopian gulf between the rich and poor. And I think that's a sort of vision of the future rooted in the last decade, rooted in like the financial crisis. And I would love us. I feel like there's this little window opening to imagine different futures. Right.
Lots of windows opening. Open a few, Andrew.
I struggle to turn that vision into something concrete. I do not support confiscatory taxes on wealth or income. I think if you create a great deal of value, you should take home a chunk of that value. I support progressive taxation, but haircuts just for the sake of haircuts because we don't like rich people, I think is a deeply bad idea if we want to reward innovation and value creation. I do support something like a negative income tax so that a guy like that barber can get topped up if he's out there trying to work hard and bring home labor income, but he's not able to support his five kids. We are a wealthy society. We could expand something like the earned income tax credit.
I was going
to
say,
that guy up.
Let's get real about guaranteed incomes.
But let me say one more thing. When we start to envision more far out alternatives to capitalism, I get extraordinarily nervous. I believe about capitalism what Churchill believed about democracy, which is it's the worst possible system apart from all the other ones we've tried.
Your turn, Astra.
Six of the richest Americans run tech companies, so since we're talking about technology. And I just do not believe that they created their wealth. I think that many, many people were involved in the creation of that wealth, and thus it should be broadly shared. That doesn't mean they couldn't be a bit richer than other people, but I don't see why we couldn't have, again, a floor and a ceiling in terms of how big the sort of spread of the rich and the spread between the rich and the poor could be.
You know that Bill Gates's father is on your side. Not that he's against his son either, but between government-supported technology and research and state institutions that train the workforce, there's a huge public investment there, and he says tax it.
Yeah, massive public investment in technology, and which is then privatized, and this has been demonstrated by scholars. And so I don't think that it's ever quite as simple as I made my fortune, you know, let it be mine, and you know, maybe we'll keep you from being utterly destitute. To me, that's just not enough.
Andrew, take the moment to stretch the public conversation beyond Bernie or the Donald.
The best way to help out people in the middle is to have our economy grow faster. And in our book, we talk about how badly we are fumbling the Econ 101 playbook, just really uncontroversial things that will lead to faster economic growth. With that will come better job and wage growth. Our infrastructure is crumbling. We get a grade of C- or D+ from the Civil Engineering Society. Our immigration policies, I believe, were designed by our enemies because they're keeping the ambitious and tenacious people out of this country. Entrepreneurship is on a slow, steady decline in America, which is really, really troubling. And our educational system is turning out the kinds of workers we needed 50 years ago. We are blowing the basic blocking and tackling in our economy. And what I really want to run is an honest experiment. Let's get that Econ 101 playbook right and then see if we can resume this amazing track record of creating and growing a middle class.
That's a wonderful agenda. Seriously, Astra, do you want to top it off?
Yeah, I just want to say that I think that, you know, right now we have, okay, I'm just going to quote Marx because that feels like that's my role here.
Quickly.
The ideas of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling ideas. And I think right now we could also say the machines of the ruling class are in every epoch the ruling machines. We need machines for the people. We need a future for everybody.
We're going back to the beginning and Barbara Ehrenreich, the nickel and dimed reporter on low-wage work, for a last word. I asked her who she could imagine as a champion of justice and reform in her workplace. Maybe a patrician like Teddy or Franklin Roosevelt, or a populist like Lyndon Johnson. Why not the rational and decent Barack Obama?
That's my whole choice. Well, you know what that list kind of leaves out? It's the actual workers. I think we have too many economic discussions in this country that are consist entirely of lawyers or professorial types talking about this as if it were a foreign country.
Speak about your own remedies in a troubled situation, from minimum wages to guaranteed incomes to real promotion of unions, if that's what's needed. What are you prescribing?
You know, I'm prescribing really simply and minimally is not a positive program. Simpler than that, I'm saying there are things that this country needs to stop doing to its people. Stop wage theft. Stop union busting. You know, there's active efforts that are being maintained all the time that sustain this kind of inequality and injustice. If we stopped the criminalization of poverty with enormous court costs and harassment of especially people of color, that would be huge. Let's look at first what we need to stop doing to America's poor and working people.
Where would you look for a moral argument? And you wrote about it in Nickel and Dimed. You made the nice point, sounded like Hubert Humphrey. Hubert Humphrey used to say, the word efficiency will not be found in the Bible. And you talk about abortion, gay marriage, stem cell research, never mentioned in the Bible. But there are 3,000 references, you said, to people in poverty and their claims upon the rest of us. Who do we look to for that kind of traditional moral preaching?
Well, I think Bernie Sanders just gave an example of that in his Liberty University speech. You're quoting me, but I'm going to throw this back to him. You know, to say there's been an effort by a certain kind of political wing of the Christians in America to say that morality is entirely about these sex and reproduction related issues like gay marriage and abortion. And no, if there's one thing it's about, if the Bible is to be our source here, it's about poverty and our responsibility, our personal moral responsibility toward everybody who's suffering.
Thank you, Barbara Ehrenreich, Astra Taylor, Andrew McAfee, Nikhil Saval. Thanks to Teak Root for his recording help. This is the second part of a series on work, produced in partnership with The Nation magazine. You can hear many more of the workers we met this month on our website, radioopensource.org. Our hardworking producers are Max Larkin, Connor Gillies, Pat Tomeno, and Zach Goldhammer. George Hicks is our engineer. Mary McGrath is our executive producer. I'm Christopher Lydon. Join us next time on Open Source.